Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
So, if you are someone who has a fear of public speaking, you are not alone. So do 75% of the general population. And that's why my next guest has developed a way for you to tackle that anxiety head on using a free VR virtual reality platform that puts you in front of bigger and bigger audiences. Dr. Chris McDonald is a fellow at Lucy Cavendish College, University of Cambridge, and he established their immersive technology lab. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Chris. It's lovely to have you. Can you tell me a little bit about what happens at a immersive technology lab, please?
Thanks for having me, Jonathan. In the immersive technology lab, we're using emerging technologies to create practical applications for education and for healthcare. So there's one project we're working at the moment, which is to help people overcome the fear of public speaking and also to help them become more skilled public speakers also. And then the other big project we got going on at the moment is called Making the Invisible Visible, which is where we're using VR and AI to better translate and visualize emissions data. So you could think of that as perhaps more of a conventional ed tech project.
And so in that one, you're allowing people to sort of see what emissions look like in the environment. Is that the idea?
Yeah. So with regard to communicating climate change, there are all sorts of challenges with that. There are psychological barriers, which we could get into. But even the way in which we measure emissions is very, very non-intuitive. It's not a standard unit of measurement like how we measure things in the normal world. And also we have the fact that with the human eye, we can't see the accumulation of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And so we're translating this data into something that's much easier to understand and also interact with and then recall. So for example, I've created virtual reality environments where students can pick up and hold greenhouse gases so they can better understand the mechanisms by which they trap heat, or they can traverse land use metrics or climb the emissions associated with different objects. So that's what that project is all about.
Now, very cool. So with this particular project, we have a sort of something that comes from your background, which is sort of a behavioral scientist looking at exposure therapy. What exactly is exposure therapy?
Yeah, exposure therapy has been around for a number of decades now. And a good way to think of it is like levels in a video game. So if someone's trying to overcome the fear of spiders, which is called arachnophobia, if on day one with a therapist, they throw a tarantula at them, that might be too much. But they might be able to start by holding a drawing of a spider on day one, because we're talking about people that have phobias. So these are very, very strong fears that are debilitating for them. So they might be able to start with holding a picture of a spider, and then maybe a week later they can hold a photograph, and then a week later they can hold a toy, and then maybe a real spider, but for 10 seconds and, you know, 5 minutes and so on. And eventually they're holding a tarantula, but that might be 10 weeks later. So it ultimately applies a form of gradation. Joseph Walpole pioneered this, would call this systematic desensitization, where you break down this big fear into lots of different smaller versions of fear-inducing stimuli. And we find that when that's coupled with what's called reciprocal inhibition, which is where you practice relaxation exercises at the same time as you're exposed to your fear, it can ultimately lead to fear extinction if they continue the treatment.
I mean, I've heard that. I'm sure lots of people have heard of it. But does it actually work? Because there are still people in the world that have fears of things. And if this is a very, I mean, if it lived up to the hype, surely no one would be afraid of anything. Does it work?
Yeah, you touched on a good point, because ultimately it does work. It has a lot going for it. I might say some criticisms in a minute, so I'll start by saying some positives. It has a lot going for it. It's the most well-evidenced treatment. It's highly effective, up to 90% of the cases. It's highly, highly effective. We've been using it for decades. It's the gold standard of treatment. It outperforms medication. So it has a lot of things going for it. My concerns with it, which is what you're touching on, is the scalability of it. So if we take glossophobia, the fear of public speaking, we know that most people have some form of speech anxiety, but very, very few people are able to access the treatment. So there's a huge gulf between those. And in other words, the scale of the solution is not commensurate to the scale of the problem. So what I want to do is find out why that is the case. And when we look into why that might be the case, it looks to be related to costs. There are lots of different friction points. But if you pursue private treatments, then you have very significant financial costs, which, to be frank about it, it is completely exclusionary for most people. They're far too significant. If you pursue free treatment, like on the NHS, then you have very significant time costs. It's around 2-week referral, 10-week waiting list, 12-week treatment protocol. So 24 weeks in total. That's just not the viable option for a very anxious student that has a presentation in a week or two's time. To address that in the lab, I want to create, therefore, solutions that are not only as effective and more effective, but they need to be free and instantly accessible. Then I think we get to this scenario where fears can also become a choice, like what you alluded to.
Okay. And so you have created a virtual stage for these participants to take part in. Can you take us through the thinking behind that and what actually people go through? And then I'm going to give it a go on my headset here.
Great. Yeah, so it's, you could think of it as a digital form of exposure therapy. So, and a good way to start is thinking about how a conventional student might practice. A conventional student will practice their presentation coming up. They'll practice alone in their bedroom on their own. That's a very controlled, comfortable environment. And there's ultimately no audience. Therefore, when they then present in class to, say, 10 or 20 people, that can feel like a significant step up. By contrast, on this platform, you can start by presenting in virtual reality to an empty classroom, but then you can scale it up. You can then start presenting to 5 and 10 and 20 people, hundreds of people, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people inside virtual reality stadiums. Then subsequent presentations start to feel like a step down. So it's a gamified journey where the VR training environments become increasingly challenging.
Well, I want to talk about how that works in a bit, but I'm going to try this on with my virtual reality headset. So I'm going to put this on and I can see. So I can see in front of me, I'm in some sort of a lecture hall, and there's, I'm not going to explain virtual reality, it's 2025, look it up. But essentially you are virtually in a room, and I'm looking around and I can see there's about 100 people here, and they're all not looking at me at all. They look very, very bored. And I guess the idea is that I'm supposed to deliver a talk to these people, even though they couldn't care less about what I'm saying. Is that right? So they won't be reacting because this is a video, it looks like. Is that right?
Well, there are multiple ways that we've built the training environments. Some are using live audience captures, but some are entirely CGI. So it's a combination of both because we want to create this scale and we have to build it in certain ways so it works on different devices, but it's really mixed methods. So what you're looking at is some combination of actual live captures, but also augmentation to create this, to make it more fear-inducing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this would be, I mean, I've been here many times. So for me as a public speaker, I hate a room like this. Is a cold room. I hate a room like this. And I would have to work quite hard to get this audience engaged. But obviously, you know, to get that engagement and to see your work paying off, that requires a bit more tech than just, you know, a video or a CGI audience. When people start talking and the audience doesn't react at all, is that a good experience for them? Do they start to benefit if they start going from no one in the room to a full stadium? Have you seen results from this? And what have they been?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple things just to touch upon there. There is a lot of tech baked into this platform. There are feedback mechanisms. There's an AI coach that helps you write your presentations. There's a record and playback feature so you can get feedback on your performance as well as your content.
Oh, really? Okay, that's cool. And so how does that work? How the AI listens to my talk and tells me how good I am? Is it just judging the content or is it judging my delivery as well?
Yeah, we had to break that down into two components. There's a bit of a funny story with how I built the AI system because without going too much into detail, I suppose, but the way you would go about creating an AI is you really need to think about good quality training data. It's a bit like a recipe is as good as what you put in to begin with. And when I first went about building an AI coach to help people with presentations, I fed it all of the best presentations ever written, things like the top 100 speeches of all time. But then what I noticed is the coach was far too stern. It was much really, really critical, which makes sense because if it's grading, if you like, students.
Against Steve Jobs' iPhone speech and you're a student talking about potential ways of analyzing cell differentiation. Yeah, I can see why it may think this isn't good enough.
Yeah, so it's actually something that I'm continuing to titrate and dial in because you really don't want it to discourage anyone. You don't want it to produce the equivalent of a page of someone's you know, beloved script and it's scribbled out in red pen. That's sort of what the equivalent was like, because it could improve every word. You can make a presentation better and better and better. So we're still adjusting that. But the way it works at the moment is it gives you encouragement. It helps you translate ideas. It gives you ideas on how to add a metaphor if something's a bit too complicated, how to make things more concise. Because ultimately, I want to maintain people's unique voice as well. I don't want everyone that uses the platform to end up sounding the same. So there are some interesting mechanisms like that. But with regards to the overexposure therapy, so traditional exposure therapy that's conducted one-to-one with a therapist, that seems to have a sort of a natural limit, perhaps due to logistical reasons. When someone's practicing a presentation, they might present to 5 people, and then 10 and 20 and 30, but it tends to cap at around 30. They have to orchestrate that in real life. Because I'm in virtual reality, I can go significantly further beyond that, like I mentioned, all the way up to 10,000. And what I'm finding is that, and I call this overexposure therapy, the idea is you train in hyper-extreme scenarios that you're unlikely to ever encounter within your lifetimes. It's like running with weights or a high altitude.
You're Beyonce on stage.
Yeah, exactly. You're running with weights and at high altitudes. It gives you extra confidence and strength, just like performance athletes would do. And what I'm finding is that this is looking to be extremely effective at providing impact at speed. So in an experiment that's, the results have now been published actually in the journal Frontiers, for our first trial, we found that a single 30-minute use of overexposure therapy significantly reduced anxiety, significantly increased confidence, but also significantly increased enjoyment. And that's really positive, because I mentioned earlier as well that fear and anxiety is maintained or worsened through avoidance. So if we can create scenarios where people are not only better at public speaking, they're more confident, but they're proactively pursuing opportunities to present, that will lead to fear reduction in the long term.
Absolutely. And one thing I would say about public speaking is you really feel the emotions of the speaker on stage. There's nothing worse than seeing someone uncomfortable on stage. You feel it 100% yourself. And when you see someone who enjoys being there, is buzzing off the crowd, that is, you know, that's exactly what you want to be. So that's where you want to find yourself. And so have you found any students who were crippled with anxiety who are now delivering TED Talks?
Yeah, well, give them time. They'll get there eventually. I do see some scenarios where there is a very, very quick response. So when I was building this, I want to make sure that I'm building something that's not only highly effective, I want to build something that can and will be used. So I want to make sure it's very easy to use. So as part of this, during the development, the lab went on tour and we spoke to tens of thousands of people. We did exhibits at really high-end, the latest, greatest science and technology festivals, but we also did demos in people's living rooms and at community centers and at marketplaces, because we wanted really diverse feedback. And what I found through some of those, there was one localish event where there was a little girl and she was so anxious and she was terrified. She was shaking and she wanted to try it, but she wouldn't come into the room. And then I went outside and I was speaking to her and I gave her some neuroscience tools to slow down her heart rate, because there are things you can do, some eye movements, some breathing exercises. Then she was quite calm. And then she came into the room and she would be happy to watch other people trying it out. And then she tried out an audience of zero. But then before long, she was actually singing Taylor Swift on the virtual reality stadium to that fake audience of 10,000 people. So we're not far off getting someone into the level of being completely debilitated, getting a TED Talk.
Who knows? That could be the next Taylor Swift. She'll thank you in her Grammys acceptance speech. Before we let you go, you know, you have done a lot of work on trying to understand public speaking. Can you give us some top tips for people who want to get rid of their nerves and really be able to focus and enjoy their public speaking, please?
Yeah, I think I would give 3 if I had to tips. And what I would preface that with, when I started this project, I was very, very open-minded. And if there was a tip out there that someone had said, oh, it's helped me or helped my friend or whatever it is, I used it at a wedding speech and it worked, I was more than willing to give that a go. But I would only continue that to the next stage if there was a peer-reviewed paper that showed it was efficacious. And unfortunately, most of the tips we hear haven't been studied. So I don't want to repeat those, because we don't know is the honest answer. There's also another category of tips and things we know that are efficacious. They do work as an anxiolytic tool. They slow your heart rate, but but you can't do them while presenting. Things like, we know a sauna can make you feel relaxed. You can't, unless you're giving a presentation in a sauna.
I might try that. I would be very open to that.
Another category is breathing exercises, but unfortunately, there's so much pseudoscience mixed in with it that it's really difficult for people to pass out. There are some tips online that technically, when you look at the mechanism, it actually speeds people's heart rate up. So the three tips I would give are lateral eye movement. That's a new neuroscience tool, which is shown to quieten the amygdala and suppress the fear response. That's where you look to the back of the room as you're presenting, you scan left to right. The other one is prolonged or emphasized exhalations. And you could do that with a breathing exercise called 478 or physiological sigh. You could look it up. That involves prolonged exhalations that lifts up your diaphragm, that there's a mechanism.
You breathe in, you hold, you breathe out.
Yeah, but you breathe out longer than you breathe in. That lifts up your diaphragm and that then slows down your heart rate. That's an automatic response. If you do it correctly, it will work. And the third one is to practice in virtual reality with those two techniques. And then if you keep that going and you increase the audience difficulty, then you're going to feel much, much less anxious. And we're seeing that with all sorts of people now.
Very interesting stuff. Dr. Chris McDonald from the University of Cambridge. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.